Hey everyone, welcome to episode 7 of Refuge Radio. I'm Gaines Taylor.
And I'm Brendan Bell.
And we're very excited to have you today. As every episode, we're always excited to have you.
We are.
Always. And so today's really exciting. We have the poet, theologian, linguist, and Padraic Otuma. And he is one of the hosts of the On Being podcast and also wrote the book In the Shelter, among other works as well. And we had a wonderful discussion today. Like, it blew my mind, honestly. And yeah.
No, I am definitely going to be thinking about many of the things that he talked about for a very long time. It's a very challenging and very, very insightful. And I think the thing that I appreciate most about our discussion is that I feel like something that Padraic is good at, and I noticed that in his book, in our conversation, and the other avenues that I've listened to him or heard him speak, is that he is good at celebrating humanity. And I think there's a narrative within a lot of church spaces and religious spaces that demonizes humanity. And I think he brings such a wonderful, beautiful perspective to that in this podcast. And I'm excited for y'all to hear it and for y'all to be challenged. And then afterwards, hopefully y'all will consume some more of his content because it is top quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And spoiler too, just little thing, he reads some of his poems in this. And like, I wish we could have hit pause for about 5 minutes just to meditate on those poems. Yes. 'Cause like, there's so much in them, and you may have to do that as listeners. You may have to listen to the poems, hit pause, give yourself about 5 minutes to just like feel what was just said, and then go again. Feel free to have the space. I mean, it's a podcast. Feel free to do whatever you want. Right. But like, I mean, I wish, but it was live. We're interviewing, so we didn't have the time to do that. Before we do that, we're going to do a little new segment before we jump into the interview called we don't have an official name, but what are you reading? What are you watching? What are you listening to? And we both did the same thing this week. I was going to go see it, and Brendan, you had seen it before I did and told me and got me even more hyped up, the movie The Eternals. And it's a Marvel movie, so some of you may be rolling your eyes right now. But Brendan, I'll let you start. Like, just thoughts on The Eternals.
Yes. So back up. I'm a huge cinephile. I love films. I love movies. I follow directors, writers, all of that stuff. So Chloe Zhao has been someone I'd followed for a while, and when she was signed on for Eternals, I was very excited to see what she was going to do with that. Her last film, Nomadland, won Best Picture this past year, which was an incredible film. If you haven't seen it, it's on Hulu. It's great. You should watch it. That blew my mind. I loved that movie. And so I was very excited to see this movie. And it had been getting terrible reviews. And I was so nervous. I was like, oh no. Like, I think part of me is like a little fanboy. I'm like, I really want Chloe to succeed. I want her to do well. And so I kind of went in with very low expectations. And I personally was blown away. I loved the movie. And I think to the point after I was sitting there with my sister and my nephew, and we had gone see the film together, and we were sitting there afterwards, during the credits, I really don't understand why people didn't like this movie. Like, it was beautiful. It was well acted. It was clearly created by a filmmaker who knew what they were doing and knew how to tell a story that had depth. And I have a lot of theories about why people didn't like it. But most of all, I think what is most interesting about it for me is that it was really a journey into non-dualism, in the sense that it's so many of the stories that we tell that are popular, like Star Wars films, Marvel films, tend to be, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. And it's very clear who is good and who is bad. And this film, that is not the case. There's a lot of moral ambiguity. Characters really weigh their decisions. Characters you might think are good do things that are evil. It's so complex. And it's so interesting. And I think also there is a thread, without spoiling a lot of it, there is a thread that is really associated with religion, religious trauma, spiritual trauma, spiritual abuse, and basically these eternal beings questioning, having an existential crisis is really kind of
the
plot of this movie. And I think as someone who has gone through, who is not an eternal, well, I guess I don't consider myself an eternal being, but, you know, up for theological debate, I guess, but someone who is mortal, but who has experienced religious spiritual trauma, who has been a part of a system that is basically tells you, this is who you are, this is what you need to do, end of story. And to begin to question that, I deeply resonated with the film. And it was a very meaningful experience to watch that for me as someone who has gone on that journey. And perhaps I can see why someone who maybe hasn't gone on that journey would not resonate as deeply with the film as I did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved it for all the same reasons you did. I do want to quote part of it, and because I don't know if this is too much of a spoiler, but there's one character who, they are a child or childlike, I would say, in body. And there's one point in the movie where they're really frustrated with how they are. And they say this quote of like, "Why did Arishem make me this way?" as they're talking to someone else. And that quote hit me on so many levels, like just all these characters, just with this sense of purpose, with that religious purpose, you know, internal being and like existential crisis. Because that quote like hit me as growing up, like, and we kind of get into this with the interview and just like people putting shame on us as who we are as queer people. Like it hit me in that sense. But as someone also who has a disability, it's like, why did the divine, you know, like make me this way, and kind of like what's purpose through this? I don't want to do spoilers for the movie. You should go see it. And there's so much more than that. But there were I've never been so emotional in a Marvel movie before. But there were multiple times I got choked up and probably teared up a few times too. But yeah, it was excellent. If you want to see a movie that's like full of deconstruction of religion and non-dualism, like you said, and all these fun things, do it. All that being said, that's what we're watching this week, or did watch.
Yes. Yes.
It will not always be Marvel movies. We will say that.
Right.
But we're going to get into the interview now with Padraig. We know you're going to enjoy this. It's a great interview, and let's get to it. Padraig, welcome to our Refuge Radio podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Me and Brendan are both very happy that you're here.
It's my real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Well, before we get started, I mean, tell us some of the projects that you've been involved in, some of your work that you've done, just to give our listeners kind of a background of who you are.
So I have trained in theology as well as conflict resolution. So for many years, I've worked in conflict resolution in Belfast. About half of that really was looking at the ongoing impact of British-Irish conflict and the partition of Ireland and the resulting, the conflicts over hundreds of years, and especially the most recent impact of that. But then the other half was working with clergy and congregations and communities of believers of Christianity for whom, who are cautious or conservative or exclusionary of LGBT people, and working with them on the one hand thinking theologically, but on the other hand thinking through what conflict resolution and group dynamics understands about having conversations about change, and seeing whether any of that would help or make things safer for the LGBT people in their congregations who may be out or not out. And for me, that was never the question, as to nobody should ever have to come out. But I still think that I was hoping that I could be involved in amplifying a voice of inclusion, and also working alongside some people to say it is possible, even if you don't want to become fully affirming, it is possible to make it slightly less awful. And so I've tried that in various iterations over years. I'm sure we'll talk about that. I've got some critiques of my own approach even, but I'm a pragmatist, so I keep on trying to figure out what's going to help. And all the way along, I've written and read poetry. So poetry, conflict, and religion are the three interests of my life.
Yeah, and I mean, that's how I got introduced to you. My partner gave me your book a few months ago, and in the shelter, and I really enjoyed it. It hit me. I had to take it very slow, honestly, because it hit home in multiple parts.
And then you started sending me messages.
Yes. And I was really concerned about that because I'm like, I do not want to come across as a stalker. And no. Yeah. So I just figured, you know, the internet's an interesting place, and I'm sure people who are writers get some interesting messages from people. So, but yeah, thanks for responding, and we're glad you're here. Brendan, any initial thoughts?
I just recently read your book. I have very much enjoyed it. I think I am excited to kind of mine the depths of your mind and hear more about your approach to reconciliation and kind of what that could look like for us. I think that kind of exists in this space where we're part of the LGBTQ plus community and also have ties to the religious community. And there are these two factions that are kind of at odds with one another. I did air quotes, but none of our listeners can see that. So I am very excited that you agreed to join us, and I'm very interested to hear what you have to say. So
my pleasure.
Tell us a little bit of your journey growing up in the church and growing up gay, and just for our listeners to get a little more of your story.
Yeah. So I'm 46. So I was born in 1975. So, I mean, I was one of those people that I just kind of, at the age of puberty, I realized, oh, I'm whatever that thing is, that's definitely me. Like I had never a moment of ambivalence about the question as to whether I was gay. I didn't have that language at that stage, but I went to an all boys primary school, and so, you know, every second insult to between the fellas was calling somebody a faggot. And I mean, we knew what that was. Of course we did. It was a person who broke the code of boyishness or manliness or whatever it was that we called it. And that was everything from my being interested in gymnastics rather than soccer to eventually me realizing, oh, I am not interested in girls the way the fellas are interested in girls. And that, I suppose, brought in a practice of secrecy, of course. You know, everybody who is living in places of not feeling safe or living in an environment where they're not feeling safe has to come up with all kinds of life-saving practices of being discreet and private or secretive, all of which I applaud. I would hope that we could move into ways of being more safe, but that isn't always a person's opportunity. You know, there are so many situations where the circumstances needed to change. So I'm Catholic, and so my parents were involved in the Catholic Charismatic Renewal. And then when I was 18, I didn't get into medicine. I wanted to become a doctor because I like people, and I thought that doctors spend lots of time with people, which was untrue. But that was my naive reading about what doctors do. So I joined a missionary organization, an ecumenical missionary organization, that was also very charismatic, and I lived in the place where I worked. So that organization did some very brave work when it came to questions of Catholic-Protestant dialogue. I learned a huge amount there about what dialogue looks like, and it really did set the ground for a career later on in conflict mediation. But that organization also was an organization that thought that if you're gay, or homosexual, as they would have said, that you either have a devil in you or you need some reparative cure. So my first year, there were three exorcisms. And then after that, there was a couple of years of reparative therapy, so-called. And those were terrible years, you know, awful. People have had it much worse, but for me, it was pretty awful. Quietly then after that, I managed to find a way to come out to myself. But it was many years really before I could even tell other people. And I lost some friends when I did come out to them. And, you know, there's all kinds of humiliations that happen in those situations, which I'm sure lots of your listeners can also relate to. So, yeah, it was in my 30s really before I began to have the opportunity to feel safer in my life. by which stage I'd finished some qualifications in theology and conflict. And so began to think, well, once I was safe enough and far enough away from abuse, I thought, well, what can I do to contribute to increasing safety for other people? I got a big job in 2014 as the leader of Corrymeela, which is Ireland's oldest peace and reconciliation organization. And I was the first Catholic and the first gay person to have that role. And so the BBC did a profile or said a thing saying that, you know, I was the highest profile gay Christian leader in Ireland. And I corrected them to say I was the highest profile out gay Christian leader in Ireland, because those are entirely different things. And for me, it's never just about the individual. It's about the system within which we're working and the circumstances. So, and that caused, I mean, we got horrible letters of utterly predictable. But it also meant that some folks who were not safe enough to come began to quietly get in touch. And we formed a kind of a quiet group to give support. Corrymeela had taken a unanimous vote in 1981 to be fully inclusive. So Corrymeela has a long history of profound courage, I think, when it comes to inclusion of LGBT people.
That's awesome. Padraig, during your story, you mentioned in your early 30s or in your 30s, that was the time where you felt safe and or felt a semblance of safety. Mm. You could be more yourself. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? What did that safety look like? Why? What was different at that point that created that for you?
Well, it was structural for me, Brendan. I had stayed working with a particular Christian organization from the age of 18 to 32. And in the last few years of that, I had some lovely, wonderful colleagues locally, you know, who were, who knew I was gay and, you know, but there was always lurking behind it the quiet idea of, if I started a relationship, what would happen? And I, every now and then I'd broach that even theoretically, and they were like, well, we're not sure. I suppose we'd have to have a talk. And even that was too much for me to just go, I don't want to have a talk. Like, I'm not 14. So I left that organization. And for me, it was finding a way to move formally away from living and being paid in a circumstance where people had power over my life that was inappropriate. And that was the circumstance that I really needed, just to find a way where it was another important part of my life, but not something that anybody could fire me about, and to work in situations. And unfortunately, too, to be in friendships where that was the case. I had a lot of friends and still do who are, I suppose, deeply traditionalists. That might be the way that they describe it when it comes to their reading of LGBT people. I won't cut off relationship with them, even though, of course, it's painful to realize that they believe in a hell that I'm going to be populating. But there were other people that just cut off relationship with me when I came out, or changed the relationship by beginning to send abusive messages. That was painful, but also helpful to realize, my God, look at what's been lurking underneath the surface of this friendship so long. So it was material to learn from. But yeah, I still do hold out hope that there can be the opportunity at some point to have an honest conversation with people who said terrible things. You know, I think it would be interesting. I'm not afraid anymore. I used to be, but I'm not anymore.
That's beautiful.
And certainly coming out is not just a private journey. It is always a public and a systemic one. The question for me is, what is the environment in which somebody's coming out, rather than, oh, why haven't they come out yet? That's none of my business. B, it is utterly ignoring the profound reality of present threat. And for me, the question is, how can the circumstances change so that if a person wishes to talk about their private life, they can? But it's always about reading the environment for me.
I found that question difficult from people who are in the queer community and outside. Why haven't you come out yet? I would get that pressure from both sides. And it's like, well, I'm not ready to. Or, you know, it's basically, you're not me. You're not in these scenarios or this environment that I'm in. And I think it's such a true thing.
Yeah. Well, one aspect of a radical response is to recognize that many people have the option and the right of privacy in their life. And the idea that a queer person's intimate life or relationship life is public intellectual property, I think it can be a radical thing to say, I'm I'm discreet about my sex life or my relationship life, not because you're going to be fired about it, but just because you want to be discreet. I'm not like that. You know, I'm happy to talk to anybody about anything, but I do recognize that for that, one of the radical options to consider is that having the possibility of privacy in your life is a radical thing. When you're free enough to truly hold that as a choice. And it's the when you're free enough is the most important clause in that.
Yeah. And that's definitely impossible to do when you're in a situation where that part of your life is being policed.
Yeah. And threatened. Like quiet things about, oh, you know, we'd kick you out. Or if people are involved in a church to say, if we found this out about you, well, you couldn't preach or you couldn't play the music or you couldn't, you know, be on the welcome team or you couldn't work with the youth group. Those are all the presences of threats. It has been a surprise to me sometimes to work with people who say, no, LGBT people are so welcome in our congregation. And then you go, to do what? Like, could they preach? Could they read? Could they do this? Could that? No, they couldn't. But they're so welcome. Like, well, there is a need for an examination of what welcome means then.
I echo that. I feel like in many spaces, it's like we are welcomed to be tolerated, to exist in that space, and then not much beyond that.
Yeah, or to make them feel like they can pretend to be inclusive. Which is, and therefore, when somebody says, you know, you need to work at your level of LGBT inclusion, they go, no, we have an active homosexual in our congregation. You're like, what's their experience? Do you know? And are they free enough to tell you the truth? And if they told you their actual experience, would they find that whatever little bit of engagement that they that is tolerated from them would suddenly be curtailed? These are all questions of power. What is it? Annie Dillard says, the way you live a day is, of course, the way you live a life. Or how to live a day, of course, is how to live a life, something like that. And I suppose what she's saying is that the little can often contain an enormous amount of information about the large. And I find that in tiny little interactions, that the power dynamics there usually are an echo of a larger power dynamic.
Padraig, I wanted to go back to something you were talking about, if it's all right. Where you said you will not, or you have not cut off relationship with people that you consider more traditional.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, and then there's a lot of people that can't do that or feel unsafe doing that. I guess, could you kind of unpack that a little more for me? What does that look like for you? And how do you maintain your own sense of mental well-being, spiritual well-being, safety, and still remaining intimately connected with people that think privately terrible things about you
or publicly?
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
I suppose it's important to say, first of all, that that's a choice I'm free to make, and if someone isn't free to make it, well, then that shouldn't even be a possibility or a guilt or a pressure. If you're not free to make a choice, well, then you need to be in a safer situation. I'm safe enough to be able to make that choice freely, and also it's not a choice I'm making permanently. It might be in a year that with certain relationships I just go, that actually has caused too much pain. So I don't think of the way of maintaining relationships with people with a more traditional point of view as something I have to do or something that people have to do. So that's really important to say. I suppose I'm interested in recognizing my own, that I can be an asshole. And so therefore, just because somebody else is being an asshole about something that I consider to be a matter of justice, that maybe it could be that I could believe that there might be a change of mind possible. So I don't define them by everything that I don't define the everything of them by what they think about whether I'm going to hell or not, because people have a lot of opinions in their lives, and the idea that it should only be on that in freedom and choice that I would judge them, I suppose I want to hold out the possibility that someone, when I'm profoundly mistaken, might also think, well, it's worthwhile to try to stay in some kind of relationship. So there's that. I suppose, I mean, when it comes to the question of religion, I am, you know, I've continued to study theology. I'm doing a third degree in theology now. So like it's the question of theology, asking the question of God and engaging with the texts that have been so formational in the Christianities of the world. Those are very important things with me. But, and I do that as an utterly happy prayer practicing agnostic. I don't really care if there's a heaven or not. It's not up to me. I think there probably isn't, but I'm interested in having a conversation about what the relationship with power and language and liturgy and ritual is in the world. And Catholicism is as bad as the worst of them and as good as the best of them. So I'm not interested in a supremacist approach. So within the context of all of that, I have an intellectual curiosity too about what does it mean to be a person in relationship with an ancient text? And that is literary for me as well as intellectual. So therefore, when people say, well, what about Sodom and Gomorrah? To say, well, will we have a conversation? And I thoroughly enjoy the conversation, not because I think there's only one way to interpret it. There's multiple good ways of interpreting it. I've been formed really by some relationships and connections with Jewish people who have changed the way that I engage with text. And to just think, if you can't argue about it, well, then you're demeaning the text. So let's have a damn fine argument. And I find that people who are involved in religious communities, even the ones who I disagree with deeply, they have a deep integrity of living a life in relationship with the text that they give an authority to. And I don't, but I do have a deep relationship with that text. And I enjoy the conversation, even when we disagree. I mean, I'm 46. It has taken a long time to get to the stage of feeling safe, you know? After the exorcisms took years. And I mean, an exorcism in public where people are screaming at the devil in you, and that's just the first. Those things ingrain a level of shame, or they ingrained a level of shame in me and a level of self-hate and all kinds of experiences that took a long time to work out and really does still have some serious impacts, you know. The reparative therapist that I used to go along to used to ask me to account for any erections I'd had during the week that I thought were inappropriate. You know, were you ever turned on by somebody? Which is a strange kind of invasion to just think, well, why are you asking a 20-year-old to talk about their hard-ons? But I didn't have that level of questioning to ask that when I was 20. I've been formed to be a good Catholic in the sense of you respect religious authority. And because he called himself one, I gave him the respect that he didn't deserve. So I do want to give voice to fury. I know people tell me I have a quiet voice, so that sounds like I'm not a man who has fury, but I just channel it all into art. Let me read a poem of fury. This is called The Exorcism. And the first exorcist I had was from the country of California. I don't judge all of America by her, but there's a reason why America is in this poem. So it's The Exorcism. It's a sonnet. I wish you weren't American. I wish you didn't see intrinsic evil in me. I wish you hadn't dragged my secret from me. Now I know you knew already. Someone squealed. I wish you didn't put your hands on me while you were screaming at the devils in me, all my homosexualities. I wish you'd never gathered people around instructing them to pray in tongues or read from Revelation or chant Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. I wish you'd shut up and I repeated Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. I wish he'd answered. I wished you dead, and I was frightened at the violence in me and the nest of demons in me. I wondered where they lived, in my semen, in the dreams I had of being kissed. Why did they breed in me, my God, my exorcist? So, like, that took 20 years to write. So, It's important for me to give voice to fury and to give voice to the kind of rage that can protect you for a while. But I suppose I'm always interested in seeing rage or fury as the first step of safety. If it remains the permanent step, I think it can be damaging to the individual, to whoever's listening, or to me, or to you, or whoever. Yeah.
Is there in that poetry? In the not the poetry, the thought, but, you know, in that, in my opinion, there's this rage, I would say, that's justified in defense and the sense of protective and calling out. what the wrong was. Like, yeah. I don't think all rage is necessarily, it's how you use that rage. I think that's I'm trying to get around the saying.
Oh, totally. My life has been totally saved by rage and anger. Totally. Because I had to believe in myself enough to say that was fucked up. And because I didn't for a very long time, therefore, I kept on staying in situations that were full of horror. And that isn't just a personal choice. There was a systemic organizational choice there too, you know, from the organization. But I think to get angry was to allow myself to believe that there was something worthy of being angry about. Whereas if I think I'm a blot on the, you know, stain on humanity and an aberration of the order of creation and an intrinsic moral disorder, as the Catholic Catechism would put it, but then I'm not worthy of being angry about, either by someone else or by me. And so the question of anger is intrinsically related to the question of value and how is it that a person's life is valued and what is valued and what not. It's why I don't like when groups say, we, you know, everybody's welcome here, irrespective of gender or irrespective of sexual orientation, or irregardless of gender or irregardless of sexual orientation. I know what those groups mean. And, you know, ultimately, their sentiment is what is, that's fine. But I want better language. I want to say we profoundly value all genders and all sexual orientations here. You're welcome to your privacy, but we also honor your life. Rather than, oh, you know, we won't make a big deal about it. That is a terribly low bar for me in terms of the question of group participation.
Yes. I just wanted to say that was such a beautiful picture of rage and of anger. And I definitely, there are several things in that that really resonated with me. And especially I recall I wasn't in a specific session exactly like that, but in prayer sessions with people praying over me to get rid of my homosexuality or anything like that, I remember also praying my own prayers, like, God, like, please let this end. Please let this. And you showed that so beautifully, that there's these almost parallel tracks of agendas and desire. And
totally. I mean, I have been part of public advocacy and public debates regarding the question of banning conversion therapy in various places. And nobody or very, very few people who have a formal affiliation with a psychoanalytic and psychotherapeutic association in their country are practicing this shit. Okay. So on the one hand, anybody who's going to be legally affected by the ban probably is already in support of the ban. So for me, the question is how can the informal experiences like healing prayer, like saying, oh, it's just not God's best for you, like saying God has a better plan, like saying, oh, you're just broken in your sexuality, let's engage in some kind of faith-based intervention into the broken parts of your life, etc. Those are the things that I would like people to put serious moral attention around, and not only because it's banned, because you can't ban prayer, and that's what people are saying, but because it's dangerous and that people are being reckless and not paying attention to the overwhelming evidence from LGBT people who've been put through all kinds of terrible, what would be seen as mild experiences of healing prayer, or let's just get you a good man to accompany you to kind of help you in your experience of manliness and brotherhood. Many of these environments have what I would almost call an addiction to an imagination of masculinity, and they don't give a damn about women. They really care about men who aren't being proper men according to their imagination of that. And those kinds of interventions are insipid and dangerous. And so many people who mightn't have gone through exorcisms or formal therapy will say, yeah, but there was a quiet hum for 10 or 12 or 20 or 30 years to just say, yeah, you're broken and God hasn't healed you yet. And that is as damaging, if not more, I think, than kind of the melodrama of three exorcisms, which I suppose they were short in the sense of that the longest was an hour. So in comparison to 30 years, that's a terrible thing.
I never went through a program per se, but sat with many mentors, quote unquote, air quotes here as well for the listeners, who did want to know what were you thinking about? You know, what was this? And sometimes it became like just where I was just conditioned almost to like, there weren't even the questions anymore. It was just, yeah, here, let me just admit my thoughts and things. And it's like, looking back on that, why is that needed? You know, there is no one asks that of any other, you know, group, for, because there was no growth in that. And not that there needed to be, because, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And it's just, it frustrates me looking back so much that I like gave up so much personal, private parts of my life for people who didn't deserve that knowledge, who didn't earn any trust, and who didn't need to know that. And yeah, like, rage comes out of that too, what you're talking about.
And I mean, so many of the accountability groups that I was part of were all really, and they were all done by gender, with an imagination that there's two, and that men and women in separate small groups or accountability groups. I mean, ultimately we might have called the men's one masturbation discussion groups, because that's absolutely what was considered to go, this is when it gets the most juiciest, and when somebody would confess to wanking, then therefore other people are like, oh my god, me too, or whatever. And like, to think back on it, even intellectually, it is such a limited understanding about your body and about pleasure and about energy and about what it means to have a healthy relationship with your sex drive. What, you know, all these fellas in their 20s talking about this in a way that was curated to be profoundly a thing of shame. I just think that that was setting all kinds of time bombs in our lives for people, for men of all sexualities in that environment. It was setting time bombs in our lives about shame and about not paying attention to the bodies we have and not paying attention to the serious reality of pleasure and the serious reality of a sex drive, and then the way within which to talk about having a sex drive and having a body in a way that could be something to do with integrity and ease and privacy and disclosure, all within a safe environment, if that stuff is going to be, is going to work. I wanted to just be better. As it was, it had terribly predictable speeches. And I just wish, in all those sessions that I had to sit through, I just wish that I or somebody had had the courage to say, what are we talking about? Like, let's speak about something more interesting rather than focusing in a certain sense on an idolatry of pleasure. Well, no, a demonizing of pleasure, but at the same time it centered pleasure as if it was a terrible thing, and ultimately it was the only thing we talked about, rather than, you know, where are the clothes you're buying coming from? Who's making those, you know? How are we acting when it comes to questions to do with discrimination? Like, those are serious questions of accountability. How do you spend your money? What do you give away? What fears are you carrying? How do you exercise your power? Those are serious questions of accountability, not what you're doing with your cock.
Yes, I feel like I'm like a an old lady in the front row at a church waving her white hanky with everything you're saying. Like, yes, amen. It's so much more tangible to talk about those things. Like, we can know, like, you know, an orgasm happened, like that physically happened, and that was bad. I'm doing air quotes again, everyone. But it's like greed, power, like these things, they are not as tangible. They're more muddled. It's not clear. And so it's harder for our little reptile brain part of ourselves to like demonize those things. Yeah. So yeah, I so agree. And it's so ultimately tragic that it's like we focus on these things that we can see clearly, and yet we miss the bigger things that are actually degrading our morality and integrity in our society.
Yeah, for sure. Let me find it for you. I've got a poem. I wrote a series of a new series of Stations of the Cross for a book that came out last year, a book that is theological explorations of sexual trauma and violence. And I wanted to think about the Stations of the Cross, because the Stations of the Cross are a kind of a powerful devotion that you find in Catholic as well as other liturgical communities. You know, 14 images of the time from when Jesus of Nazareth was condemned to the time that his body was laid in a tomb. And I wanted to come up with a new list. And Jesus for me is just a word for, I suppose it's just a word for like a blank canvas of the every person. So here's a poem called Jesus Fantasizes. And this is Jesus of Nazareth speaking. It's the de-sexing that bothers me. As if I never had a boner or some lust. As if I had so much of God's business to consider that I never wanted kisses or a nail run down my back. I woke every morning the way men wake every morning. I sought some comfort in some touch and thought that much could be achieved if people made more love more often. I think I'd have made a pretty average father, by which I mean okay, by which I mean I wish. I would like to age and watch my children grow. I would like to hold on to my body.
Damn. Yeah.
I love art like this that kind of really delves into the humanity of Jesus. Because growing up, that was not something that was... It was something we like tipped our hat to, but it wasn't actually something that we really believed, because we were just like, he is God. Yeah. And yeah, like it's almost like we deeply believed like humanity is just evil. Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah, that's just like the aspect of when in the garden Jesus asking for the cup to be taken from him, and it's such a human moment. And like it's like, I don't want to do this. I mean, to me, there's like a fear in there in a little bit. And it's like, that's, you know, interpreted many ways by many people. But like, I just see that as such a point of like, I want to be here longer, you know, and I want to, you know, I don't know. And there's moments like that we kind of just gloss over or interpret different ways. And I say we, I use big C church and like how I grew up. So yeah. I don't mean that every single person.
A good friend of mine used to say that in that very example that you're talking about, Gaines, where Jesus of Nazareth goes to the Garden of Gethsemane and is deliberating really in a certain sense about what to do in response to state-sponsored torture from the Romans that's coming his way. And he positions his three friends with him and says, pray. But a friend of mine said, was he planning on running away? Wouldn't that have been a reasonable consideration? How could he have been human if he wasn't? Because what's gained by being tortured by an empire that doesn't give a damn? Wouldn't he have been able to say some other interesting things in his life had he been able to stay alive? And I think that is a magnificent imagination about what's being described there and the possibility of it. And I think accompanying the possibility of that interpretation with an imagination that says, and that wouldn't have been a failure. That would have been preserving life.
Yeah. Padraig, I know we are running low on time, and I really want to talk a little bit about your work in reconciliation. So could you tell our listeners just a little bit about your work in that and what that has looked like?
So there is both the kind of theological and the political sides of this. So the political side of it is that, you know, Britain has been present in Ireland for 500 years, and that has had various shapes about what that means. Certainly it influenced the fact that most people speak English as their first language in Ireland now, as opposed to Irish, what Americans often call Gaelic. And the presence of a colonial force has utterly changed the face of Ireland. There was what's called a famine, but wasn't a famine. We call it the Great Hunger. There was plenty of food in Ireland to feed people. A million people did not need to die in 3 years, and a million people did not need to leave in 3 years. Some of those starving people were loading boats at gunpoint filled with food that was going off to feed the empire. And the Dublin government at the time had issued a request to the British government to close the ports in Ireland so that the food could be used to feed the starving. And the answer was no. with the understanding that if there are fewer Irish people at the end of this blight, well, then that'll be easier to control. And so that's the 1800s. Then with the beginning of the crumbling of the British Empire in the 1900s, and Ireland becoming mostly independent, but also partitioned in 1921, there was an outbreak of 30 years of terrible violence, Irish responsive violence, from 1968 to 1998. So really, when we talk about reconciliation in the context of Ireland, we're talking about the broad sweep of what does it mean that for 500 years there's been a larger power next door who've had various levels of presence, and that people have been willing to murder in the name of an Ireland that they wish to seek to be more independent. How do we pay attention to the mess of that? You know, a couple of years ago, a young journalist was murdered. You know, these aren't issues of the past. You know, she was 28, I think. And so there are all kinds of terrors that you're paying attention to within the context of this. And so the side of it that I was mostly involved with through Corrymeela was bringing people together to have discussion about how do we live now. And the longer I stayed in that work, the more rarely I use the word reconciliation, because reconciliation implies this is where we're going and this is the good outcome. I suppose I'm interested in having a fruitful and creative conversation. It might be that the end of it, that somebody goes, I found a way to settle some of the grief that I've been carrying, but I hope never to see you again. That's a really creative response, do you know? There's all kinds of possibilities for what good and creative and safe and kind of community building responses can be. And reconciliation can sound like a one size fits all, or that people need to enter back into a relationship that was never there in the first place. So, I mean, I'm the same with forgiveness, you know. Maybe it's only the dead can forgive their killers. And so I would never want forgiveness to be a burden to people, even though in my life, forgiveness has certainly helped me enormously. So, yeah, I've through Corrymeela and through Mediation Northern Ireland and Community Relations Council and Cooperation Ireland, loads of charities and organizations of goodwill, I have been one of the many people involved in these processes of bringing people together to talk about the kinds of traumas we carry, to think in a certain community building and maybe therapeutic with a small t way, how is it that we can learn something as a society and also honor and maybe support people who are carrying things that nobody would wish to carry. Yeah. So that's been a work in my life for many years. And then the other side of that is to bring together people, large consortiums of people who want to talk about LGBT people in the life of the Christian churches or in the public life of a society in the north of Ireland. Or I've worked in Uganda and Scotland and the States and Australia with this as well, to look at how is it that we have a kind of a conversation. I am utterly, utterly uninterested in neutrality when it comes to these conversations. I am totally unconvinced that there is a middle ground. I none of that interests me. What does interest me is how is it that communities of people can come together and stay in the room and disagree very seriously in a way where there's the possibility of understanding each other about the impact of power within the thing that we're talking about. That really interests me. One time in a gathering, somebody started off, they were from a more traditionalist point of view, and they started off by saying, look, we've got a lot of people from the gay community here. We've got a lot of people from the Christian community here. And I think we should just start off by understanding, look, there's been hurt on both sides. And so one of the things that imagined was that there was LGBT people and then there was Christian people, and that there weren't LGBT Christian people. You know, there was a kind of a binary imagination in the room. And then it also completely flattened the idea of impact. You know, there's been hurt on both sides. So I interrupted it. I was facilitating the meeting and said, look, we've got some people here who have been beaten up or threatened or fired. And we've got other people here who are being held accountable for derogatory language you're using in public about LGBT people. And you're embarrassed or maybe even ashamed, or maybe somebody shouted at you because you were hurting them. Those are not equal but opposite things. what we have to recognize is the imbalance of power here, and the way within which to be held accountable is not tantamount to persecution. And so if you, I can't change your mind about LGBT people, but I would hope that if you're holding your views because of a religious point of view, and especially a Christian point of view, that you would have the courage to speak plainly and to not play games. And let's try that in this room. That's my hope for what conversation can be like. And I don't know that I'd call that reconciliation. I think I ultimately believe in arguing, but arguing without recourse to violence.
Yeah. I am curious, in these conversations that you have with LGBTQ church theology, what have been some situations where you felt like those conversations went well? And then what were some situations where you felt like they didn't? And what were some of the factors involved?
You're asking a very helpful question, Brendan. In conflict resolution theory, there's always this way within which the theorists want to say exactly what you said there. Why did that work? And how can we understand why it worked? And I think it's a great question. I mean, it's a big question for my life. And then people who are both theorists but also involved on the ground are kind of saying, I have no idea why that worked. I'm a bit bewildered. In fact, I'm shocked. Or I have no idea why it didn't work. So two examples. I've told this story a few times, so I'll try to rush through it. I was convening a few days together for some clergy, all of whom self-selected to come along, but they were all from a really conservative point of view when it came to LGBT people. In fact, a number of them said that their preferred terminology to describe their faith point, their faith approach, was fundamentalist. And they said they embraced that as an honoring about how seriously they took the Bible and they took Jesus of Nazareth. And so one of them had said pretty regularly pretty difficult things in the room, hard to hear. I brought along a little group of some LGBT people who were all safe enough and willing to be present in the room. Anyway, it was a residential over a few nights, and on the Thursday night, one of the people, while we were making a cup of tea, said to me, I hope you appreciate how much of a sacrifice this has been for me to be here. And I was thinking, my God, I'm just trying to make a cup of tea. And he said, I'm missing my favorite television program tonight. And I was like, oh, right. I thought he was going to talk about something existential. And I said, I'm sorry that you're missing your program. What's your program? And he mentioned a political program on the BBC, kind of a Thursday night discussion about what's been happening in politics in the north of Ireland that week. And I was shocked and I went, my partner's the producer. And he went, what? And then he said Paul's name because he was that much of a fan of the show that he knew the names of most people that worked in it from the credits at the end. And he was like, what? And all along I'd been trying to convince him of the humanity of the lives of LGBT people. But suddenly he was really curious. He had all these questions he wanted to ask of me about, and what does Paul think of it? What about this? And what about that? And kind of get the insider scoop about a thing that he loved. And that seemed to be the pivot moment for him. The next day in the group, as we were finishing, he said, before we go, I want to ask the homosexuals in the room a question. I'm like, oh my God, what a terrible, you know. Then he said, here's the question. How many times since we have been gathering over the last few days, during that time, how many times have I said words that have wounded you and bruised you? And somebody said, ah, you're grand, don't worry, you know, that you're asking the question is enough. And he went, don't patronize me, answer me the question, how many times? And somebody went, like, it's actually hard to count. And he said, I have work to do. I was extraordinary to experience that. And somehow he was doing work on his own volition, and he was the one leading himself deeper into his own moral reckoning of the impact of him on the lives of other people. Because then he asked a follow-up question. He said, do you mean to tell me that before you come into a room with me or some of my friends here, that you have to kind of steel yourself, you know, to put up with stuff? And then one of the other LGBT people in the room said, it's not just coming into the room with you. It's turning on the radio and wondering, are you going to be on that talk show or that religious show on the radio? It's coming into work, coming into this, it's going to church, it's going to... And a conversion had happened for him, where it wasn't that he was leaving Christianity behind. He was going deeper into it. And nobody done that convincing for him. It was fascinating to witness that. And then another time I was working with a group of people all good clergy who I think would consider themselves on the slightly more liberal side of a very conservative denomination. And they were all wanting to have conversations with, you know, real live LGBT people. And so there was a few there. And after a few sessions, somebody had said, can we really just go into the scriptures? Can we just look at those texts? Can we look at Sodom? Can we look at the lists from Paul? Can we look at the reference in the book of Romans, etc.? I said, grand, like, let's have a look. So after about six sessions, we had a session where we looked at those. And before we started, I said, I do need to say to you that I'm curious, are there any other populations of people where you pre-imagine the possibility of a relationship with them based as to how you interpret the text? Like, if some people who you consider to be foreign move next door to you, would your first question be, let's look at the Bible to see how I'm supposed to show hospitality or not? And said, who else would you ask these questions about? And I had thought we've been together five times or six times. We have said some challenging things to each other. And I had thought asking a systemic question of power here before we go into talking about the Bible, to look at the environment within which we're talking about the Bible, this group is up. And I was incorrect. They were not. And my question, I think, meant that nobody was paying any attention to the rest of the conversation. I am really willing to make those risks, because I thought I took a calculated risk. We've been together for a period of time. We've been trying, and I really do want to ask this question, because we can look at the Hebrew and the Greek, that's easy. But to my mind, there's the bigger question about why, and what are you going to do about this? And why are you defaulting to this? And where else are you saying you use the Bible like this? And let's have a conversation. And it did. I'm glad I did it. But what I noticed is that it didn't work. And that's simply interesting information. So those are two examples of mediative approaches, group conversations, where, I mean, I literally couldn't count the amount of times that I've been involved in as a mediator or as a kind of a facilitative leader in those environments. And for me, the point is to try, and to try in a way where we're hoping to make progress. And also demonstrating trustability of being able to have a question asked back, which is always important. Of course, it has to be reciprocal. I bring power into the room too.
Yeah. It's so interesting that I know for myself, and you even called it out when I asked the question, it would be so nice if there was like a neat formula for ask these questions or come with this spirit and everything's gonna be great, or you know what I mean. And it's just not that way, and I think you beautifully demonstrated that in these two examples, that it's like we're dealing with humans with complex emotions and experiences, and it's just there's no one thing.
No. I mean, sometimes with groups of people who are getting together to talk about something where people would wish each other to change their minds, you know, you've got two sides, to be crude about it, and each side would wish the other could be convincible. Sometimes as an opening exercise, I've said to people, I'm going to ask you to trust each other right from the word go. And with a minute, tell a story about a time you changed your mind. And to say, I promise that I won't take what you've said and use this as a way to manipulate you later on when we're talking about whatever it is we're talking about. But I do want to recognize that we are, most of us, probably always changing our mind about something. And it's been fascinating. And to say, you know, somebody said, I thought this about this for a long time, and then something happened and it changed everything. And then, you know, a follow-on question from that is, and what would the you now say to the you then? And what would the you then say if it imagined the you now would be a possibility of their future? You know, one man had changed his approach when it came to a certain point of view of politics. And he said, you know, the younger me would call the older me a complete sellout. And I said, and what does the older you say back to the younger you? And he said, well, you know, keep reading. And I thought that was a lovely pastoral conversation. And what was so interesting is everybody has a story like that about something. And I'm really interested in saying, so let's talk about this rather than I'm going to convince you, really to talk about what's your relationship to change. and how has your life changed? And what does a change look like in advance as opposed to afterwards? And how is it that fear manifests in advance of a change, or actually afterwards you realize I was frightened of the wrong thing, or I was making something up to be frightened of because I was just using it as an excuse to prevent change. So those are really interesting conversations to have as a group. And to my mind, that's the profound level of engagement that's going to work when we can speak from narrative points of view that can foster individual and then from that systemic change that will mean that fewer people have to suffer.
For our listeners who may not be out or maybe at college and, you know, a Christian college and not have a safe space or anything, what would you tell that listener right now? What would be some words of advice to them through your experience?
Well, I mean, through the work that the two of you are doing, what's clear is that you're highlighting that there are possibilities of safety. And I think anyone who's in a situation of unsafety would hopefully know that they are, but probably feels like, but it's not going to be accessible to me because of, and then there'll be a really important list of reasons. And I suppose I would hope that someone might think not everything is accessible to me, you know, or they might feel that, but to think, well, which one can I work on in terms of putting myself in a situation that's safer? That might mean just saying, well, every second week I'm going to go to a different church. You know, maybe a place where that's possible. Or that person I know is affirming and I'm going to talk to them. Finding ways to say, you know, so much of the language that we're that's forced, which is to say, you know, you're same-sex attracted or that you have unwanted same-sex attractions. Those are little pieces of speech acts that are manipulative. You know, I had unwanted same-sex attraction because I was told I was going to hell. I was told how I'd die. And I was told that I would have no friends and no family and no faith and no future. So, of course, being gay was unwanted for me because I was told that this is the future. And I think having the daring of the imagination to say, what if they're wrong? Because so many of us who are or have been closeted have just been told over and over again that the fault lies in us. And I'm not saying we're faultless, of course. I'm not interested in a kind of an imagination of that. But when it comes to fault and when it comes to sin, sin was present in my life when it came to my younger life, when it, you know, regarding being gay. It was just that in that one instance, the sin wasn't in me. The sin was in the people who were abusing me. And so it isn't that you just think, you know, everything goes. It is to say, ask the deeper question about sin in the context here. Who is sinning against you? And what would it mean for you to be in a situation where you can be accountable for things that you actually do have control of in your life, rather than bearing your body the burden of somebody else's fury against you for being LGBT?
Thanks for that. Finally, what do you have coming out that you would like to promote? Anything you're working on?
So I present a podcast called Poetry Unbound, that's with On Being Studios, where we take a poem and I offer a reflection on a single poem. I read it, offer a short reflection, then read it again. It's short, it's about 15 minutes long. And I work with a team of people that produce this. And it is a joy of my life to turn to poems that have got a profound relationship with the question of what does it mean to be alive? So that we're in our fourth season for that, and it's all free. You can listen to you can listen to back issues as well, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. And then there's a book of the same title coming out next October with Norton in the United States and with Canongate elsewhere, called Poetry Unbound, which is 50 poems as a way to live your life.
Well, that interview was just excellent, and I'm still blown away by that. I also just want to tell everyone too, like, if you've been enjoying everything that we've been doing with the podcast and with our different storytelling events, and we've got a bunch of events coming up in the new year and even a little before the new year, as well as all the other activities we're doing, we would love for you to join us like on this journey. And if you would be feel called to like donate to Refuge, that would be such a blessing to us. If you go to the link on the bio of our Instagram or Twitter or any like of our social media, you can click there and there's a link to donate. And there's no pressure in that. We don't want to be like penny pushers or whatever the term is, like, but that would just be, if you want to join us on this journey, that would be awesome. And that's all we have to say for that. But Brendan, do you have any final thoughts?
I hope that you found something in Podrick's story that resonated with you, that you're able to take into your own life. I hope that as you go into your life, you're able to find a greater sense of safety, a greater sense of refuge, and hopefully some hope as well. So thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to Refuge Radio with your hosts, Gaines Taylor and Brendan Bell. Audio production and music were provided by Inclusion Audio, with musical help from Lyndon Braun.